Content de rentrer dans le studio pour une petite visite et entrevue.
Et encore félicitations pour... Hey, I guess we better change into English. People are going to get upset. I want to congratulate you on this, I think it was the Huffington Post, national coverage of your presentation to the joint review panel studying the Northern Gateway project. Is that correct?
That is correct. I had the distinct pleasure and satisfaction to speak at the Enbridge public hearings in Kelowna some months ago, and I think I was delighted to see that some of my remarks made it into the Huffington Post, thanks to Captain Trevor Green, a sea captain on the West Coast, who's just written a book, in fact, about the whole experience of environmental threats to the ocean as a result of the Northern Gateway Pipeline and some of the tanker traffic up the coast.
Thank goodness there's somebody doing that, because, they seem to be presenting some, trying to woo us into believing that it was all so safe. I'm glad to hear that there's a sea captain. Tell me about that presentation, though. I think it was rather unique. Something about a prescription, I believe? Go ahead.
Well, as a physician, it seemed appropriate for me to frame my remarks in some degree of kind of a medical terminology. And since this whole issue is a pathology that's affecting not only the province of British Columbia, not even just Canada, but the entire planet, it seemed appropriate to address it in that kind of framework. And then that would afford an opportunity for future considerations.
Okay, but what I believe you made 4 points. Can you? I don't have them in front of me here, but I remember you wrote a prescription, and do you remember what they were?
Well, you know, a doctor writes so many prescriptions that he finds it hard to keep track of any one of them. I can remember a couple of them. I actually didn't bring them with me, but one in particular that I think stands out and is something that many Canadians are not aware of, and that is the fact that our Prime Minister's office has powers that exceed those of prime ministers in almost all of the other democracies in the world, all of the European governments, the British democracy, the American government, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, you name it. Ever since Pierre Trudeau added some administrative responsibilities to Prime Minister's government some decades ago, added powers have been given to that office to the point now where it can essentially veto anything that is said by any administrative body, such as the Privy Council, such as all the various committees attached to the House of Commons. It's really quite extraordinary how much power the Prime Minister's office has. And it seemed to me that unless we address this particular issue now or later, but sooner rather than later, we were going to be in trouble at regular intervals with prime ministers who, like the current prime minister, is very, 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 very apt to recognize how much power he has and to use every ounce of it to achieve his particular goals.
Yeah, a bit of a change in our whole system. Anyway, I was hoping we'd come up with one of those. I recall one had to do with fixing up First Nations. The relationship with First Nations.
You're doing a great job of reminding me of what I said.
Go ahead.
The relationship with First Nations is still far from resolved, and it's far from being addressed by the current federal government, which has in fact done things deliberately, it almost seems, to upset and disturb First Nations. Many Aboriginal communities are located in the northern part of the country, and as such, they have been able to maintain their lifestyle from thousands of years ago. And it's a very efficient and effective and, in fact, very healthy lifestyle. We could do well to imitate many of the things they do. But by passing a number of legal enactments through the House of Commons, the Prime Minister has formally challenged not only the lifestyle and the way of living of Aboriginal communities, but also their culture. Most recently through the First Nations Education Act, which appears to be giving a lot of money to Aboriginal communities to mount educational programs, but in fact has changed the veto powers back to the minister in his cabinet responsible for the Indian Act, and therefore transferring power essentially to his office because he has control over his ministers. So it's actually a switch that takes control of content of education away from Aboriginal communities and puts it in the hand of the government, which is a very paternalistic behavior. And not untypical for the current government.
Yeah. I was going to try and find something that we could segue into what we really want to talk about tonight, and that is the RAR, or the Riparian Area Regulations. And just to start off, tell me, let's have some sort of a definition of what's the RAR.
Well, maybe I can offer a segue, because I'm one of my other recommendations was that we have to heal our relationship with the ecosystem. We have to come to understand that the environment is not something separate from us, nor are we or our economy separate from the environment. And until we understand that reality, old-fashioned economics, which sees money generation and wealth generation as occurring exclusively within the human community, but without any recognition of the fundamental, in fact, the critical role of ecosystem resources to make our economy work, we're in big trouble. And that's why we have such things as global climate change, global warming. We have species destruction. We have, for example, in the West Coast, the potential for wiping out wild salmon stocks by turning to farmed salmon, which are stored in a radically unnatural way in pens that allow the distribution of refuse on the seafloor, and also the distribution of things such as sea lice and perilous viruses to wild salmon stocks, for which the wild salmon stocks are ill prepared. So it's that kind of inability to understand that the ecosystem, that keeping the ecosystem healthy is how we keep ourselves healthy. That failure to recognize that reality is a huge problem. Now, the Riparian Areas Regulation is an attempt in the British Columbia context to create a measured approach towards waterways and lakes and other bodies of water, which was designed essentially to take the responsibility for this management process away from the provincial government and give it into the hands of private developers. Now, the only part of that that I think has become the primary weak point is that it relies on a notion called the professional reliance model. Now, if you don't know what that means, it sounds like gobbledygook. It's some, bureaucratic phraseology that doesn't mean anything to a person. But essentially, this is what it means. It means that the government has decided to declare every single biologist or professional who deals with biology in the environment to be identical, to have the same mindset, to have the same emotional makeup, to have the same intellectual capacities, to have the same professional training and insight, and under all circumstances, to act the same when confronted with a problem to be analyzed.
Yeah, okay. So we're talking about the riparian area regulations, and really what we're talking about is the environment and the protection of the environment. And it sounds like, now, when was this, when were the RAR enacted?
It was enacted in 2003 and implemented in 2004.
Okay, so it's about 10 years.
Yep.
And using the professional reliance model. Now, before we even get into some other really interesting questions, do you think there are some strong environmentalists within the Liberal Party?
The Liberal Party of British
Columbia? The government of British Columbia, starting back in with Gordon Campbell's government, they were elected in 2001. I would think there must have been.
I have no doubt that there are not just strong environmentalists, but people who recognize the close relationship between the environment and us, which I think is the key. I say that because Paul Martin, a former Prime Minister of Canada, said a good environmentalist who's not a good economist is not a good environmentalist. And a good economist who's not a good environmentalist is not a good economist. In other words, the economy and the environment are so intertwined you can't talk about them separately. But I say that there are people who understand that relationship within the British Columbia government right now, but I don't think their voices, generally speaking, are heard, because the predominant prevailing ideology within the government is that developing the human economy at the expense of the natural environment is perfectly okay and can be carried on almost in an unlimited manner.
Yeah, okay. And we're getting into some academic sounding stuff. I want to cut to the chase here.
Let's cut to the chase
and see really what we're talking about here. We're talking about these qualified environmental professionals. So one of the things that you said, a political movement that fools itself into crafting national policy, or in this case provincial policy, based on bad evidence is a political movement that will sooner or later face a reckoning at the polls. At least that's the hope, but that's not true on issues like climate change, where action is needed quickly to prevent a disaster that will happen slowly. There, the reckoning will be for future generations. And I would think that this RAR and what's been done in British Columbia, I think that what you're getting at is that that applies to this phrase. So the question is, what was the government? Is this deregulation by another name, basically?
Yeah, it actually is. That's a good point, because in this case, deregulation was disguised as something else. You take a developer, the developer wants to build somewhere that's next to a water course, and you say to the developer, no, 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 sir, you cannot build there unless you hire what is an official designation, a qualified environmental professional. Now, this is a person who's taken a weekend course at a community college on Vancouver Island. I think it's, I can't remember which one it is, I think it's Camosun College, but a weekend course, but is also either a forester, a trained biologist, someone who's in an engineer, a geoscientist, and there's also another technical requirement that I forget. But basically, somebody with training in the kind of life sciences, not human life science, but plant and animal life sciences. But that's where the good part ends and the bad part begins, because who's supposed to pay this brilliant, qualified environmental professional? Well, it happens to be the same company that wants to do the development. Not the government, not an independent body, but the very person or group or organization or company that wants to create the project.
Hold that thought, because we're going to get back to this business about paying the piper. You're listening to CKVS 93.7, Voice of the Shuswap. The show is The Core of the Matter. My guest, guess who? Dr. Warren Bell. I'd say he's an activist environmentalist, because our topic is all about the environment and the riparian area regulations. And it may sound a little intricate, but actually it's not that bad. One of the things, the other quotes, back to my guest here, Warren Bell, the governance in the age of information distortion is a tricky business. But you were talking about qualified environmental professionals. If I may, I just want to, this is another quote, I think you wrote this, the riparian area regulation isn't a regulation because it doesn't regulate. It facilitates environmental destruction by developers because it has no penalties. It contains no provision for canceling a project, so any proposal can theoretically go ahead, even if badly planned. And we might get an opportunity to have a look at one. It fatally relies on information bought and paid for by the very person or corporate entity that stands to make money out of the development it is supposed to control.
Indeed.
And doesn't provide for checking that purchased information. So, tell me a little bit more about this qualified environmental professional and how it works.
A qualified environmental professional can be somebody who has strong ethical values, who has independent capacity for independent thinking, and lots of professional training. But the fact is that even a person with all of those qualities, when offered a substantial sum of money to accomplish a particular task by the person who wants that task to be accomplished, is moved, is swayed towards consciously or unconsciously favoring the proponent who is paying him or her, favoring that development that the proponent wants to put in place. I know that well because research has piled up in my profession, the medical profession, showing that what are called sponsored studies, studies paid for by somebody who's trying to make a point or trying to sell a product, are always biased. The typical average bias is if it's a sponsored study, then it's about 75 to 80% likely to be favorable to the product or the service being presented.
Well, it stands to reason that if you hire a qualified environmental professional, they're probably... Excuse me, go ahead.
It stands to reason that this person, if hired, would follow their own professional values and training. But the trouble is, in real life, that isn't what happens. Even though it stands to reason that that person would follow those values, the reality is that they don't. And the science reveals that that's the case. And the other side of the reasonable sort of thought is that if somebody does pay you a lot of money to do a job, you're likely to do it in the way that would benefit that person the most. And that's analogous to the literature on gift giving. If somebody gives you a large gift, even if you don't like them, you're probably going to think better of them after you got the gift.
Strings attached.
Strings attached. And they're often emotional. They're often unstated. But, you know, somebody handing someone else a fat check tends to make that person feel great.
Well, we do have there's been a lot of talk lately, and it's funny how it seems to be diluted, conflict of interest. Mm. And you'd think that there's a glaring conflict of interest between the person that you've hired and you're going to pay to do something. You know, we just, before we went to break, talked about he who pays the piper calls the tune. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's called a maxim?
Or yeah, that's it. That's about 400 years. I actually looked it up.
Did you?
Because I wanted to see where it came from. And it comes from Germany, the earliest written form comes from Germany in about the 1600s or a little earlier. So it's not new. And in one form or another, it's part of all cultures. We all know that if you give somebody a gift, they're going to favor you more than if somebody, you know, give them a kick in the teeth. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so we know that. So recently, and we might as well get to it right now, mm-hmm. I believe that the ombudsperson, Kim Carter, mm-hmm. Wrote a report.
She did, and it was quite an eloquent report. the gist of the report is that she reviewed the riparian areas regulation, but more importantly, she reviewed how the provincial government had used the RAR, as it's called. So the RAR is how we tend to talk about it in shortened form. She reviewed it in some detail. In fact, her full report is, I believe, it's 170-odd pages. What she said was that there were 17 areas where she thought improvement could be made, and she made 25 recommendations. And of those 25 recommendations, her arguments were so compelling and probably so difficult for the minister to refuse to acknowledge that he accepted all of them, every single one. He did fudge on one. The one that he fudged on was the one that said he's going to review all of the QEP, or the Qualified Environmental Professional reports, for the next forever. He said, well, I'll do it for 2 years and then I'll see if it's really worthwhile. I think that's because he knows that when you start to fix the beady eye of government on professionals, they start to get nervous, and then developers start to say, well, you're delaying the process in one thing and another. Frankly, I think if you're trying to do a big project right, a little delay is always better than a big brouhaha in the middle or subsequent to the project being put in place. Anyway, Kim Carter, made a lot of recommendations, and the government accepted all of them. And they basically said the RAR, the Riparian Areas Regulation, was not being implemented fairly. It did not offer the public any significant opportunity for input. And I can tell you from direct experience, working in this community, we had a project that we were addressing And it was a big problem.
Right. And notwithstanding the fact that it will be a little controversial, and I don't want to bring up past, but I think it bears repeating because I think there's some lessons to be learned here. So let's go through the scenario of the smart centers and see how the riparian area regulations and how they were applied and how it came to pass, if we may.
Right.
So let's start with the very first, we know that Smart Centers wanted to build over on that site, right? So we carry on.
And it's interesting because that wasn't their first site. They were actually looking to build on the other side of the highway, closer to town. And that site, although it was on, would have been a lease from the Adams Lake Indian, Indian bands, was not a contentious site particularly. The municipality didn't like it because they wouldn't have got taxes from it. But other than that, it was something that most people could accept. But when that went into default, then the smart centers looked at the other side of the highway. The key to them actually being able to do that was the fact that the agricultural land reserve, which had control over the land, was persuaded by repetitive approaches from the municipality and the owners. They were persuaded eventually to surrender this land and take it out of the agricultural land reserve. And I know that a number of farmers in this community are distressed because there was no consultation with the farming community whatsoever. And it's of some importance that right now the provincial government is looking at the agricultural land reserve and looking at ways to change it, and there is much concern that they may change it in the way of making it weaker. Now, what we found was big problems at the time. It was not fully implemented. Agricultural land was not protected, and that let the whole cat out of the bag. Then what happened after that was, of course, the proponent, in this case Smart Centers, looked at the land to see whether it was successful, whether it was amenable to development. The difficulty is there that was no one who was consulted with real expertise to look at whether this was a good idea, except for the Smart Center's qualified environmental professional, who they paid to do a report. The report they did was actually radically erroneous, if I can put it.
We'll get to that. Yes. We're going to get to that.
We will.
But I just want to make a point here, because this is something I think that you wrote. The Nature Conservancy of Canada, Dr. David Suzuki, the Canada Research Chair in Community and Ecosystem Ecology at Thompson Rivers University, and several other acknowledged experts all agree, this is in 2009, that this site is a critically important salmon habitat and the wrong place to build.
That's basically what everyone who didn't have a vested interest in this project said. They said, this is not the right place to build. And it would be fair to say that the only objection to this development was related to the site on which it was to be built, not the development per se. Whatever people thought about that, that wasn't an issue. The issue was the site. And the site was important because it is a place where salmon fry every spring when the water is high in the river, migrate into old river channels, which are still there. They were. Now they've been paved over. They were still there. And river salmon fry, coho and chinook fry, would go into those old river channels and feed voraciously and fatten themselves up before heading out into the lake. Now those old river channels aren't available, and that, of course, everybody knows that the wild salmon population in BC are under some threat, so that has an impact on the overall picture of salmon viability.
Exactly, because the Salmon River is a major salmon river. That's the name. Salmon River, Salmon Arm Bay, Salmon.
That's right. When you say it to people who don't know the situation, you say, well, why we were concerned was because it was the Salmon River, which flows into Salmon Arm Bay, on which the town of Salmon Arm is located. Guess why it's important, they tend to say.
You talk about these inconvenient truths for smart centers. So to get around it, they hire this, they're using the RAR, they hire a QEP that you mentioned.
Yes.
And so now what happens next?
What happens next is that a number of citizens in the community, including some very well-qualified professional environmental professionals themselves, people with a lot of knowledge of biological processes, a lot of knowledge about assessing sites to see if they are appropriate for building, stepped up and became collectively very troubled by the decision, initial decision by the Minister of Environment to approve this development. And kind of wore a path to the door of the Ministry of Environment with wave after wave of evidence, studies, actual commission studies, studies we did among ourselves, studies based on data supplied by the Ministry of Environment itself, studies based on wetland science all over the world, brought this to the attention of the ministry. And this is actually probably the central point where the ministry, through the riparian areas regulation, attracted the disapproval of the ombudsperson. And in fact, it turned out that when eventually, on December the 1st, 2009, the Minister of Environment responded and decided to step back and take another look at what was going on, it was the first time, that was 2009, it was the first time since 2004 that any decision by the Ministry of Environment under the riparian areas regulation had ever been re-examined.
Hold that thought. We're going to get back to this because now we're getting into an area that gets really interesting. But I just want to take a short break. We'll have a little bit of music, too. You're listening to The Core of the Matter. Steve Corey here. With me in the studio is Warren Bell. This program is about current affairs. We're talking about the environment, the riparian area regulations. I think it's still called that.
No, it isn't. It's got a different, long, complicated name.
Yeah, well, and, don't worry about it. But at any rate, they were reviewing, actually, because of all these local scientists had sent them a considerable amount of evidence. Mm-hmm. So they reviewed what did they review?
They reviewed the decision to accept the report of the initial report of the QEP, the Qualified Environmental Professional, from Smart Centers, that made statements about the delta and the wetlands that were really quite wrong. And they finally felt they couldn't ignore the errors, I presume, anymore. We never found out what triggered the review by the ministry, but we heard the announcement and were astonished and delighted, actually. And we were astonished and delighted because, as I said, there'd never been an appeal that had been successful from the public. The ministry had either had no appeals or if they were there, turned a deaf ear to them. But this time, the weight of our evidence, I think, was just too strong.
Okay, so they reviewed it, and then what did they do? They said...
Well, they hired an independent person who actually concurred with the evidence we had presented. We had a fateful aerial photograph that showed flooding of the delta on a particular day when the exact level of the water was where the Minister of Environment said that constitutes viable fish habitat. We had found one. It was a bit of a fluke, but we were looking hard all over the place. We looked at every library of aerial photographs practically in the country and finally came up with this one. I believe it was May the 12th, 1993. On that day, the level of water in the wetlands was just the level, exactly the level that the ministry said that constitutes, you know, it's a bit arbitrary, but that's what they said, that constitutes fish habitat, if it's that up to that level.
And you found something on a tree, too, did you not?
Well, that was another thing. One of our members, Alex Inselberg, who's a vegetation and soil specialist and has been doing consulting work for 25 years, sat in the environment and saw what was going on. And what he saw was quite interesting to him, and of course it became interesting to everybody else because he's an expert. He saw a line above which the bark on all the trees was clear and below which there was sand deposited in the little cracks in the bark. And once you've seen it, it's like you've seen it forever. But until you've seen it, you don't notice it at all. And he actually sent micro photographs around with arrows for the uninitiated, such as myself, pointing out exactly where this silt line was located on trees. Above it was moss, below it was silt. And so it was very distinctive. And that hadn't even been mentioned in the report from the Smart Scoop.
So now you've got some good evidence, not only from your photograph, but you have a specialized biologist that shows right on the tree that the water goes up to this level.
That's right.
Okay, so now what does the ministry do?
Well, the ministry hired an independent consultant. The consultant agreed with us and also agreed that the frequency of flooding on the Delta was much greater than had been estimated by the Smart Center's professionals, who had actually said the Delta hardly ever floods at all. We actually, what probably helped a little bit was a picture of a well-known citizen in Salmon Arm in her kayak paddling through the apparently non-flooding forest. I think that might have been a bit of visual prompt for the ministry experts.
So they reviewed it and they came down with a decision that said you can't do this.
You see, this is where the riparian areas regulation doesn't regulate. There's no penalty for doing a bad job and there's no end point. There's no end point where you say, this is just not the right idea, you can't do it. What they say, in essence, is, we don't like your report, so do it again. And, the proponent hired QEP, Qualified Environmental Professional, is told by the proponent, do it again and, you know, make them happy. I don't care what the heck you do, just make them happy. And so they did. They repeated their report. It still wasn't accurate, but it was a significant improvement over the initial one, and in fact cut down the footprint of their planned development from about 55 acres to just around 20 acres.
Yeah, 22 acres, I believe. Okay, so that was an important point, because in fact the evidence showed that this was so. So the ministry, instead of canceling it, mm-hmm. as you said, using the RAR, because mm-hmm. there's no provision there for canceling, they said, okay, go back and redo it. And they did, and they came back with a second one.
Yes, and the second one, and there were some iterations of various reports in that process. So it ended up being several reports altogether. But the ministry essentially said that when they got to a certain point, they said, okay, it's not perfect. You are destroying some salmon habitat, but they did a little double talk and said, well, that we'll grandfather that in and allow that to happen. So there's about 5 acres of prime salmon habitat that are included in the development, but it was a marked improvement. There's no question about it. It was a marked improvement. What was originally planned would have pretty much destroyed the water movement in the wetlands and the delta, and had created a significant problem related to potential flooding, as well as destroying almost all of the salmon habitat in the delta itself.
Okay, so after that happened, and they accepted the second one, the 22-acre one, I believe it is, or something around that, during this process, did anybody, I understand the system, the RAR works on complaints, did anybody file any complaints?
Complaints against
against the decision of the QEP, I guess it would be.
The revised decision?
Yeah.
Yeah, we went back and pointed out that there was still about 5 acres. Alex Inselberg is quite knowledgeable about these things. He understands that vegetation indicates clearly how much flooding takes place, and flooding is the qualification for fish habitat. And he pointed out about 5 acres that still were included in development. But at that point, I think the ministry had conceded some ground but had lost its appetite for conceding more. And so they said, okay, we'll do a saw-off here. We'll give them the 5 acres, and, you know, they
basically approved it.
They basically approved it. And, you know, at that point, you know, how far do you go with an issue? Because the worst of the development had been averted, because the final decision was made in a very clear way, like, we are not going to back off, this is going to, because we are by this time having some regular communications with ministry officials and their professionals, their biologists. So we just said, okay, I guess that's as far as we can go with this matter. At the same time, we recognized that the process had been very unfair, and so we had presented it partway through, thanks to Frank Bugala, who's an architect here in town, and myself. We'd presented to the ombudsperson, and we'd been told at that time, when we presented it back in about 2010, possibly 2011, that there was a lot of unfairness up and down the process, and they didn't disagree with us. They said, yes, there is, but it's a systemic problem. In other words, it affects the entire process as opposed to a single act. And they felt they couldn't address it. It was too complicated. However, to the ombudsperson's credit, they kept that notion stashed away in the back of their minds, and they actually did eventually get around to examining this issue, and that's why this report came out.
Her report came out. But in the meantime, you then decided, aside from going to the ombudsperson, you decided to go to file some complaints to it's a college of applied biology, I believe?
Well, that was in the middle of things. Alex was very familiar with the college. We actually met by accident with a couple of their chief folks during, interestingly, the salmon hearings that took place at the same time. And had a chat, and then Alex sent a very detailed critique of what had been done by the qualified environmental professionals working for SmartCiters, and had received an astonishingly unhelpful response. They didn't actually look at what our complaint contained. They simply said, gave it to those professionals themselves and said, you answer the complaint and tell the people in the Salmon Arm what's wrong with their criticism of what you've done. And of course, needless to say, these two individuals weren't going to necessarily acknowledge wrongdoing, even though there was very clear evidence of inaccurate information. So they simply replied, and that was the end of it.
Is that how it works with, well, you're a physician?
Yeah.
There's a college of in British Columbia, isn't there? The British Columbia College of Physicians?
And surgeons.
And surgeons?
Yeah.
Is that the procedure?
No, it's absolutely not the procedure. If I have done something and a patient is unhappy with it, they write the college. The college then sends me a letter indicating that a complaint has been made, and they send the letter of complaint, and they give me an opportunity to reply to the complaint. However, that's not the end of it. It goes on until the complainant has also received my response and responded to that. And if they feel that the problem is big enough, they will call in a committee to examine all the information and draw a decision.
So why isn't there a better system of handling complaints with the College of Applied Biology?
The reason is that the college is a new college, and I'll tell you another reason I think is really important. People don't get as exercised about a problem with the environment as they do about a problem with personal health. You know, one biologist once told me, I've been working on environmental protection for years to protect creatures like earthworms and frogs, and then you doctors come along and you protect the environment because it has adverse effects on people's children, and suddenly everyone takes notice, and nobody's ever taken any notice of what I said.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of it, too. I don't think the College of Applied Biology perceives itself as in as much jeopardy if it ignores a complaint as the College of Physicians and Surgeons would.
I see in the documentation that I have that you painstakingly sent in a 33-page report.
Alex Inselberg did, yes.
Yeah, and it was just summarily dismissed.
Basically, yeah.
Well, let's carry on. Tell me, are there any cases where a project that you know of was stopped using the RAR, the Riparian Area Regulations?
No. And in fact, that is a built-in provision or non-provision. There is no place where the RAR, Riparian Areas Regulation, says, stop, this is crazy, don't do it, that's it, game over. There's no way whatsoever.
You're listening to CKVS 93.7, Voice of the Shuswap. The voice you just heard before me was Warren Bell. He's my guest this evening here on The Core of the Matter, in our studios in downtown Salmon Arm in the Downtown Activity Center. Let's carry on, Mr. Bell. So the next step after it's been approved now, what did water do then? What's the next step?
Well, I think we felt the experience we had gained from this process. By the way, we had no idea that the ombudsperson was working on a report until maybe a month and a half ago.
No.
But anyway, we parlayed, if you like, this experience and our quite a developed library of scientific data. I would add a very important experience we had working in a very comfortable manner with the Nisqually Lithinian Band. It was really remarkably positive connection, which emerged as soon as we kind of projected our thoughts on what needed to be done. Chief Judy Wilson and Bonnie Thomas, who is the chair of the Switzmouth Cultural Society, were very engaged in the process, and we had a very positive relationship with the leadership of the band and with individual members. It was really a wonderful experience and advanced what we were doing greatly. We could not have done what we did without their help, because their knowledge of this terrain was very deep and very profound. But after that, we decided that what we could do is look at decision-making around environmental issues in general, look at the protection of ecological values, using the example of the wetlands of the Salmon River and the process we went through there as a kind of model. And a model not just to do what we did all over again, but a model to do things better in the future, better ways to do it, more collaborative ways.
Very interesting.
We don't have all this to-and-fro divisiveness. We think that's unproductive. And so we're involving ourselves where it's appropriate with processes where decision-making has to take place and where environmental values can be protected, but not at the exclusion of economic values as well.
No.
Try to kind of link them together.
Yeah. So I guess just to end this talk about the riparian area regulations, what would you say we could conclude right now as they exist before any of these recommendations are implemented? Is it a regulation, the riparian area regulation?
It's not truly a regulation, but if the ombudsperson's recommendations are followed, it's going to become a lot more fair. For example, every qualified environmental professional report, which up till now has only been available to either proponents who commissioned it or to other QEPs, will now be available to ordinary citizens. There's going to be a dedicated website where ordinary people can go, or anybody can go, reporters from newspapers can go and find the reports that have been prepared for project development and read them themselves.
So now they'll see the light of day, they'll be transparent, and therefore I would think that the QEPs will be a little more careful now that they know that there's public scrutiny.
In addition, the provincial government is committed for 2 years to reviewing every single report that comes out, not just to make sure the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, which is all they've done in the past or in the last couple of years, but they're actually going to look at the content. Is this accurate information? And hopefully, there are a lot of experts in the provincial government still. I mean, a huge number have been laid off. But there are professionals with biological experience in the provincial government who will be involved in commenting on any report that a QEP has produced. That's a huge change as well. In addition, they're going to keep a list of all the complaints that have been made. So it's kind of like the Better Business Bureau. You know, if you've got a business and everybody thinks you're wonderful, or they send in messages saying how great you are, that's fine. But if somebody says, these guys ripped me off, or they did something that shouldn't have been done, then it'll be recorded permanently on your record. And someone could go there and find out, oh, they got a bit of a problem track record.
Oh, okay. Well,
so that kind of stuff.
At least it's more transparent, as you said, and it looks as though the environment may see a little bit more protection in the years to come.
The key problem that we identified with the professional reliance model, where professionals are given to, it's understood that they will automatically do the right thing, when we know that, even though they're being paid by a proponent, even though we know that's not true, the ombudsperson, I think, felt constrained to not examine this one fundamental principle because it is so beloved of the provincial government and of governments in other jurisdictions. In my article I wrote for the Watershed Sentinel, I pointed out that the huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico that everybody is aware of, the Deepwater Horizon spill, would not have happened if there wasn't a professional reliance model in place with the U.S. government, which is actually where the whole model came from the Reagan-Bush years. You know, hand over the responsibility to businesses, they'll do the job right. That's the principle behind it. Unfortunately, it isn't borne out by actual evidence. It doesn't work that way.
Has it changed much in the United States after the Horizon accident, which they're still finding huge amounts of oil on the coast?
I'd like to say yes, but I can't, because the voice of corporate America often is much louder than the voice of the government. And I'm not saying governments solve every problem, but in this area, without independent scrutiny outside the vested interest of a company, it's a very difficult situation to get the accurate information and have people act on it. It's really a problem. So the professional reliance model is still, it's beloved by administrations that feel the private sector will solve all the problems of society. And unfortunately, that's a dominant theme south of the border.
Yeah, it seems to be coming to Canada, too. Although it's very encouraging to see that the ombudsperson, Kim Carter, has come up with these. The experience we've had in White Lake has this business of changing the foreshore. In fact, I want to, something I haven't done yet, I want to just tell the listener about next week's program, the 13th. I'm hoping to have someone from White Lake. I think it'll be Brian Avery. And there's actually a problem there right now with the fishing, although some people say it's great. But the biologists have discovered that there seems to be something wrong. And who knows what it is. But one of the problems is a lot of people have altered the foreshore of those that are on the water, mm-hmm. and put in beaches, etc. And it bears repeating time and time again. You're not supposed, not only are you not supposed to, but you destroy fish habitat, especially food for the fish.
You know, I think what all of this represents, and maybe this is kind of summing up what the experience is that we've talked about today, and that is that if we wade in, especially if we come from an urban background and we haven't seen wild systems very much, if we wade into wild systems and impose our beliefs, our understanding of things, which is often quite limited, on the structure and just say, hey, this is a good idea, let's just go and do it, without thought, I think what's happening here is we're thinking about thinking more. We're thinking about being more thoughtful, more better informed, more educated about what the consequences of our actions will be. If we all start to do that, then the future will be much brighter than it is potentially right now.
Warren Bell, I want to thank you for coming this evening. It's been very enlightening for me, what I've understood, what happened. I want to tell the listener that you can go to www.thewatershedsentinel.ca, and then you can look up, I think that's /content/riparian areas regulation. I do have the full link here, but I don't want to try and explain it on the air.